When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he had sat down, his disciples came to him. He began to teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the land. Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the clean of heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are they who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they insult you and persecute you and utter every kind of evil against you falsely because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward will be great in heaven." The Gospel of the Lord. I'll confess to you that the Beatitudes are something that I've always struggled with a little bit in terms of how to understand them, certainly how to preach them. And I've heard them spoken of in many ways. I've heard them spoken of as sort of a recipe for happiness, right? In a sense, beatitude, blessedness, blessed are you, that the Lord is giving us a recipe for happiness in the fullest sense. I've also many times heard of it spoken of almost as Jesus describing himself. When he says all these beatitudes, blessed are those who are poor, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are the meek, that he's essentially describing himself. So he's giving a recipe for how to be more like him. But within this idea of beatitude being a recipe for happiness, you know, a path to a blessed life, it still, I think, maybe strikes us as a bit strange. I chuckled to myself. I had this image yesterday of a parent maybe writing in a birthday card or a graduation letter or giving a speech at their child's wedding or something like that, and expressing what it is that they hope for their lives and how strange it would be if the parent said, "I hope that you have poverty. I hope that you mourn, right? I hope that you hunger and thirst and that you're persecuted for the sake of righteousness." It's an odd bit of advice to be given to us. I think it also opens itself, like many things in the Christian life, it opens itself to a profound misunderstanding. Because if we're not careful, we can begin to form this picture of our God and of the Christian life as somehow being about negativity and suffering. If we're not careful, we can start to form an image of God who, for some reason that seems to evade our ability to understand, just wants us to have kind of a bad time here during our earthly life. And maybe somehow this is to pay for or to earn our way into happiness in heaven. But this doesn't really stand up to the test of reason, right? It doesn't seem reasonable to us, so why should we assert that God would, for some reason, just want us to suffer here below as a means of earning reward in heaven? So we must say that the commandments and all the instructions given by Jesus about how to live, and even these beatitudes, even the ones that strike us as a little bit odd and painful, we must have to look at them from a different light. Bishop Barron says that each of the beatitudes, I missed a transition point, so we're going to look at them in a different light. And here's the light that I propose. Bishop Barron says that each of the beatitudes corresponds to one of the four major temptations which we face in life. And you've heard of these before, that at the root of all of our temptations is the temptation to power, pleasure, honor, or wealth, you know, money, material riches. That those are the four things that tempt us to become false gods, right? They propose themselves to us as things that are worthy of worship, as things that are worthy of striving after and seeking our happiness in. And if we think of it that way, I think it's actually very easy. And, you know, maybe some of us are more, well, not maybe, all of us are probably more attracted to some of those temptations than others. Maybe there's one or two that ranks supreme. Maybe there's one that's not, you know, maybe we're not particularly attracted to honor or something like that. But most of the things that tempt us as false gods, as idols, can fall under one of those categories: power, pleasure, honor, and wealth. And what Bishop Barron says is that the Beatitudes speak against those things. So why do we experience, if Jesus is telling us this is the recipe for blessedness, for happiness, happy are those who possess these qualities, why do we experience them as negative? And I would put to you that it's not because God arbitrarily or vindictively or sadistically just wants us to suffer and jump through hoops here in this life below. It's because since we are fallen, since we are broken, since we have original sin within ourselves and the effects of original sin within ourselves, and because we live in a world that's tainted and broken by original sin, these good things that really describe how we are supposed to be and how it is that we can truly be happiness, we experience them as negative. But we experience them as negative not because they are negative, but because we're broken. Just to use a very small and strange example, I've been listening to a lecture series on modern philosophy lately, and we're kind of up into the 20th century, and they're discussing these philosophers of crisis, who I don't have a lot of sympathy for their philosophies because they've just continued the destruction begun by the Enlightenment. But one of the things that they discuss is that these 20th century crisis philosophers are sort of depressed and trying to make sense of a world that's been shattered by the First and Second World War. And in that sense, I can have sympathy for them, right? Because if you're a thoughtful, reflective, honest person, and you're living in a world that's just been utterly torn apart by every sort of violence and ugliness, how can you not be a little bit bummed out, right? So we could apply that a little bit to the Beatitudes and say, if we live in a world that's torn apart by sin and evil, how can you not hunger and thirst for righteousness? How can you not mourn over the loss or the absence of good and the presence of evil in our lives, right? So that's maybe one explanation for why that we experience the Beatitudes as negative, is because we live in such a broken world. But then also, there are the vices and the sins that live in us. And so we not only experience sadness about the world, but we, in a sense, experience sadness about ourselves. We don't want poverty. We don't want humility, right? What do we want? We want wealth. We want pride. We want to think well of us. We want others to think well of us. We want honor. We want power. And so when the Lord is prescribing for us poverty, humility, meekness, weakness, right, righteousness, a desire for good, it's difficult for us. I really like, when trying to understand spiritual matters, I really like to use physical analogies, because it's much easier for us to understand the physical world because we can see it, and the proof of the physical world is more evident. So to use two analogies from there, I forget who said this, so I won't cite it, but somebody said that to a sick person, gourmet food tastes disgusting. It's an odd thing to think about, right? If you're sick, it doesn't matter how good the food and what quality and what mastery went into cooking that food. If you're sick, it's not going to taste good to you. And it might be the most gourmet, the fanciest, the most expensive food in the world. You're not going to enjoy it. Or to take maybe a more everyday example, there's really healthy food out there for us that, maybe this doesn't apply to all of us equally. For me, healthy food tastes terrible, right? I've recently been trying to take a turn towards the healthy, and so Father Steve and I will maybe go over to, you know, instead of what we would normally eat, like a cheeseburger and french fries, we'll go over to True Foods and get a kale salad. And people tell me that kale salad is a superfood, that apparently it's there's very little negative effects of eating it, and all the nutrients you need to live to be 180 are contained in the salad. But so I know on an objective level that it's good for me, but I have formed myself to be an eater of cheeseburger and french fries, you know, or or bacon cheeseburger and french fries. And so even though objectively that food is good for me and eating it is actually going to make me better, it's going to make me healthier, it's going to make my body work better, I experience it as repulsive. And so, you know, and I don't want to get like sued or something, so it's a very good restaurant, True Foods. It's not repulsive. I like it. Now, one more physical example is, you know, doing exercise. I've heard, I'm really not trying to do a comedy routine here, but I've heard that some people get a runner's high when they run, like they get endorphins that release. I've never experienced that in my life, but I do know that your body actually gets better, and presumably your experience of life gets better as you get into shape. So working out is actually your body doing more of what it's supposed to do and what it wants to do. But if you're in the kind of shape that I am, you can only experience it as pain, right? As negativity, as something that you want to stop doing as soon as possible. So maybe these examples seem a little bit silly, but I think that they're evident to us, they're obvious to us. So I think if we take that principle and apply it to the spiritual life, we can begin to see why sometimes the things of the spiritual life can become daunting. It's not because, you know, when the Lord prescribes poverty for us or humility for us, it's not because those things actually are negative. It's because we're a little bit deformed. And so entry into poverty or simplicity of life or entry into humility, right, those things, we experience them as painful. They are healthy, but we're not healthy. So all this goes to say, not just to have a negative or fearful view of growing in the blessed life or the virtuous life, but to, I just lost my train of thought, but the point that I'm trying to make is that we should desire this life, and we shouldn't allow ourselves to be daunted or deterred, or we shouldn't allow ourselves to rationalize away the Beatitudes because they seem like bad things to us. They seem unreasonable or negative. Jesus is not unreasonable, and Jesus is not negative. When he proposes these things to us as the path to beatitude, we have to trust that he knows what he's talking about. Now, if I tried to break open each of the Beatitudes, it would be an unbearably long homily. So let me just use the first one, just to give an example of why we may experience it as negative and how we may grow. So, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This is a really interesting one because there are two versions of this one in two different gospels. So this is blessed are the poor in spirit. There's another that simply says blessed are the poor, right? Now, that's especially, we live in like the richest country in the world, and this is a fairly rich parish, so that may sound foreign to us. Blessed are the poor. In fact, poor seems to be the opposite of beatitude. Poor seems to be a curse, right? Who wants to live in poverty? I will say this, though. Maybe we can combine this, our look at this beatitude, with the blessed are the clean of heart, or another translation would be blessed are the pure of heart. And there's an impoverishment of language here, because when we hear purity to our modern ears, we often simply think of chastity, and that's an impoverishment. Because when the Lord says, blessed are the pure of heart, what he means is, blessed are those who don't have a mixed heart. Right? Blessed are those who, the Lord wants us to love him exclusively and not share our hearts with the things of this world, right? What he really wants for us is to love him and to love each other, not to love things. So the pure of heart, the clean of heart, will see God. Now, even though poverty, material poverty in this world may seem like a bad and a negative thing, I think we can, if we're a little bit open, we can see how there is something free about simplicity. Many people don't know this, but diocesan priests, like Father Steve and I, we're not religious priests. We don't actually take a vow of poverty. We get a paycheck, we pay for our cars, you know, we own things. Some people are surprised to know that. But because of that, diocesan priests have to enter into that struggle, to some extent, like you do, of figuring out just, you know, we're not absolutely poor, right? We have to pay insurance and all those kinds of things. But we have to decide how simply should we live. And I've been part of many, many conversations that go like this. Well, you know, it's not like it's evil to own things. Jesus doesn't tell us that it's evil to own things or to have goods. And then the response to that could be, yes, but Jesus does say it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than a rich man to get to heaven, right? There's something dangerous about material goods, right? That maybe it's not sinful to own things, but things have a way of enslaving us. We become attached to them. And then the response to that could be, well, I'm not attached to my things. And then, you know, say, well, then go ahead and give them all away, right? And there's a resistance there. And we can, if we just do that mental exercise, say, okay, I don't need to actually go give away everything I have today, but let me just imagine giving away everything but the bare necessities, what I need to survive, or maybe what my family and my children need. And we can start to see the way our heart becomes less pure the more we have. Somebody told me recently a story from the life of St. Francis. Early in the Franciscan order, when St. Francis was still alive, there's a controversy about how radically they should embrace poverty. And some members of the order felt like they should own some things, like they should have a house to live in and food to eat. St. Francis was a supporter of radical poverty. The Pope actually intervened and told Francis, maybe you should have a little bit of goods. You know, you should have a place to live, for instance. And St. Francis's response was, if we have things, then we'll have to have weapons and laws to protect those things. And so he intuited that as soon as we start owning things, we actually will become less free. And so we can begin, if we see things from that perspective, we can begin to see what Jesus might mean by saying, blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of God. Right? That those who don't have material goods don't have the same temptation to divide their heart. If you don't have things, you don't become attached to the things that you don't have. You're actually a little bit more free to love the Lord and the people around you and not to gain or protect or keep the things that you've earned. Now, I promise I'm almost done, but to now bring it to this version that we heard today, blessed are the poor in spirit, we take a similar sense of empty-handedness, but we bring it to the spiritual life. Right? Those who are poor in spirit are those who recognize that they are utterly dependent for their spiritual needs on God. By the way, this is the spiritual position of Saint Therese of Lisieux, who the church has named a doctor, right? The church has named the little flower a doctor of the church, meaning that her teachings are beneficial to all Christians of all times. And the center of her little theology is, I am just a little flower in my Father's field. I am not strong enough to attain the heights that, like, you know, a St. John of the Cross or St. Bernard of Clairvaux or St. Francis of Assisi attained. I simply want my Father to give me everything that I need. I simply want my Father to pick me up. I simply want my Father to make me holy. And that sort of theology of the little flower, that theology of weakness, of spiritual poverty, is what made her a doctor of the church. Now, I've told you in recent weeks that I'm going to try to, as I can, pepper in specific advice about how to grow in the spiritual life. And I would say that not only is this a great entry point, this first beatitude, not only is it a great entry point into the Beatitudes, it's a great entry point into the spiritual life. To recognize, because brothers and sisters, we are all spiritually poor, I promise you. You are spiritually poor. The key is to recognize it and to embrace it. To go to the Father in prayer and say, I come to you empty-handed. I have nothing to offer you. I'm weak, I'm broken, and I need you to do everything for me. Now, we may be tempted to feel like that's a bad way to approach the Lord, but Jesus does say to us today, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.